Hello, hello, hello. Thank you all for coming tonight. For those of you who don't know me, that fan is awfully loud. I'm Dave Fedanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon. I think you all know that the current hot topic before the Portland City Council is whether or not the City of Portland should rejoin the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. Much has been made of the fact that the City of Portland is the only municipality, state, or county government to pull out of a Joint Terrorism Task Force in the nation for reasons of principle as opposed to budgetary reasons. And so we had a very interesting session this morning before the council. It was officially a work session. There will be a public hearing on the 24th. Council may take action then, but more than likely it will be put off for a week or more after that. And we were delighted that Mike German from the National ACLU office, our Washington National office, which lobbies Congress, could be here for this work session today. And before I introduce Mike, I wanted to let you all know about a couple of other events that are coming up, so I don't forget to tell you this later. We have our annual Liberty Dinner on March 12th, and the national president of ACLU, the president of our national board, Susan Herman, will be coming out to be our keynote speaker. And we'll be honoring a longtime cooperating attorney of the ACLU of Oregon, Charlie Hinkle, with the first Charles F. Hinkle Distinguished Service Award to the ACLU. That's March 12th at the Portland Hilton. And you can buy tickets online. We also have scheduled a lobby day down in Salem to lobby legislators on our priority issues this session, and that's going to be on Thursday, April 7th. Again, there's information up on our website, aclu-or.org, and there's a link for you to sign up. If you're here because you heard about this event on KBOO this morning and you're not a member of the ACLU, shame on you. We have membership envelopes on the table over there. Please join us. We need all the help we can get, both for the battle we're in before the Portland City Council right now and all of these issues nationwide and many, many other issues as well. Michael German is currently a policy counsel with the ACLU, specializing in national security issues, particularly related to anti-terrorism efforts by the federal government. Beginning in 1988, straight out of law school, he joined the training academy for the FBI in Quantico, Virginia. And between 1988, is that better? Between 1988 and 2004, he was an FBI agent, in the end a special agent, working undercover on terrorism cases and also working in other capacities in the anti-terrorism arena. Mike took at their word, those in the FBI and the Justice Department, who said, if you see any improprieties, report them to your supervisors. He did that. They ignored him. They covered up the evidence. They tried to cover up the evidence very, very ineptly, as it turned out. And they retaliated against him to the extent that he finally left the Bureau and became a consultant for a couple of years, including for the ACLU, before we brought him on staff. Please join me in welcoming him to Portland.
Okay, so do I need this?
Yeah, I think you do need that.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, thanks very much. Thanks, Dave, for that nice introduction, and thanks for inviting me out here to Portland. I love the sunny weather. Actually, I've spent some time out here on the West Coast, so I do love coming back to the West Coast. And, you know, I think it's really important, the statement that Portland makes by not joining the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And that's why I thought it was worthwhile for me to come out and give my two cents, you know, particularly because I have looked at this from a lot of different perspectives, from actually working with a Joint Terrorism Task Force and going out and doing investigations, and as somebody within the organization trying to change it. You know, how many people heard any of the testimony today? Okay, so a good portion of you. It was interesting. There was one panel where the ACLU was able to present evidence, and I thought the city council, the mayor, and the commissioners did a great job of asking very deep probing questions and, you know, really trying to understand this issue, and I give them a lot of credit for holding a hearing like this or a work session like this and for being so attentive to all the materials that we've sent them, trying to help them understand all the issues involved. And then there was a government panel, and, you know, what was fascinating to me is it wasn't just the U.S. attorney and the special agent in charge of the FBI out here, but the Department of Justice and the FBI actually sent people from D.C., including the general counsel of the FBI, which I think shows how bothered the FBI is by the fact that Portland has taken a principled stand. And, you know, I think it's crucial to stick to that, and you know, I hope you'll encourage your city council members to vote no and to stay off the task force, because, you know, since it was amazing inside the FBI, I had been working terrorism for quite a while and knew that there were significant problems within the FBI's counterterrorism program, but those problems weren't a lack of collection authority. I mean, obviously the cases I worked using the reasonable suspicion standard, which I thought was pretty reasonable. That's why they called it reasonable suspicion. As you know, I used to tell young agents that if you can't sit down and write down why you think the person you want to investigate has done something wrong and deserves your attention, there's probably somebody worse out there, and you should devote your attention to them. It's not a standard that in any way hinders law enforcement from going after people who are actually doing bad things. What it prevents is law enforcement from going after completely innocent people who they have no basis for believing have done something wrong, but for some reason don't like what they're saying or don't like the way they look or the way they dress. And, you know, typically the people who get targeted are the usual suspects, you know, new immigrants, people of color, and political activists. And, you know, right after 9/11, the attitude change really frightened me, because I had grown up wanting to be an FBI agent since I was a little kid, and because of that had read everything there was to read about the FBI, so I knew about the bad old days, and I remember feeling how fortunate I was that I was joining the FBI after they had learned all those lessons and would never again target people for their political beliefs or use the power of the federal government to try to prevent people from speaking out or from organizing or associating in order to forward a political objective. And unfortunately, that changed after 9/11. And I knew that the dilution of standards was going to lead in a bad direction. And, you know, it also was sort of an opportunity, because I felt, as somebody who had been involved in counterterrorism and had worked successful cases and sort of had a pedigree within the FBI, that if I couldn't speak out about something wrong in the FBI's counterterrorism program, who could? You know, if somebody who had a history of success, who had never been in trouble before, who had never done anything to embarrass the Bureau, couldn't report wrongdoing within the agency, then nobody could. So it was really an obligation that I felt I had to use the process the way the process was set up. And I was surprised to find out that it wasn't set up to succeed, that it's actually a process that's designed to prevent whistleblowing and to prevent people from coming forward with complaints about the way the FBI manages its cases. And that's why the testimony today from the government was so, I don't know if annoying is the right word, because, you know, what they're saying is, you don't have to worry, Portland. We have internal controls. And if a Portland police officer sees something wrong and he brings it to our attention, we'll address it immediately. And, you know, having lived through that experience and found that that's not exactly how it happens. And, in fact, there is a tremendous amount of material that documents the FBI's continuing abuse of their authorities, whether we're talking about Patriot Act authorities, like national security letters or Section 215 powers, or their investigative authorities, which have targeted domestic advocacy groups. An Inspector General report just came out this September that really shows without question that the FBI was targeting groups with little more than the mere possibility that they might commit a crime in the future. And, of course, all of us are potential future criminals, so that's a very thin line of protection for a citizen who, again, is doing nothing wrong. There's no factual basis to justify the FBI's interest in these people, and yet the FBI feels it has the authority to collect information on them anyway. There is also a long list of FBI whistleblowers. I'm not the only one. There was Sabelle Edmonds, Jane Turner, Bassem Youssef, Robert Wright, John Roberts, you know, the list goes on of people who tried to report misconduct within the FBI only to find their own careers ended, and the people who were engaged in the misconduct just keep going right along. There is no question but that the internal controls within the FBI are insufficient to protect the rights of Portland residents and citizens. And that's why I think you have to demand that your local representatives make sure that they're doing what they can to protect your rights, because the federal government has abdicated its responsibility to do that. So I have come all the way out here, and I want to make sure that I'm giving you information that you need. So I'm happy to take questions and answer any questions that you have, either about this or about other issues regarding the FBI or the administration's policies on national security issues. Sure. The question was if I could explain how sort of the structure of the how the Joint Terrorism Task Force works and the danger in putting somebody from an outside agency like the Portland Police Department on an FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. And I think it's a good question, and there are a couple of different elements to it. And, you know, during the hearing we got into some of it, but there are really a couple of interesting elements. One that I talked about during the work session, you can read an Inspector General report on the FBI's use of what are called exigent letters. And this is something that the FBI made up completely out of whole cloth. There's no legal basis for these things. They were sort of promissory notes to the telecommunications companies that if you give me records, I'll get you a subpoena or a national security letter later, only no subpoena or actual legal process ever followed through. And it devolved into a process where literally the FBI was collecting telephone and other communications records with post-it notes and by looking over the shoulder of the telephone company representatives as they pulled up data on their computer. So a complete breakdown in the arm's length relationship between the government and these private companies that hold tremendous amounts of our private information nowadays. Well, in examining that issue, and this gets to your question, he found one of the problems was that the FBI had set up a system where they co-located the FBI agents who were seeking the information and the telephone company or communications company's representatives in one location. So some familiarity bred in those relationships to where what had been an arm's length relationship requiring legal process devolved into a system of, you know, completely illegal activity that was taking place because they all felt like they were the good guys and they were doing it for the right reasons. So the rules didn't matter because they all knew that they were good guys and they all knew that they were doing all this for the right reasons. So what can it matter that we're taking shortcuts? And that's sort of the problem that can occur when you have those co-locations and you have people that actually are operating under different rules. You know, the city of police officers would be responsible to follow state law operating in a room together. You know, and the other problem is sort of that because the government witnesses were very aggressive about saying, oh, no, you know, the state and local police officers, they can follow state law. You know, we would never ask them to violate the state law. Except if Dave and I are working together and Dave's working under one set of rules and I'm working on the other and I know I can't collect the information about you, but Dave can. So I'll let Dave collect the information because he can under his rules as the FBI. And then when Dave collects the information, I can just look at the information he collected. And it creates this sort of form over substance where, true, this local police representative didn't collect the information, but does that protect your rights at all when the state or local police officer is using the information that was collected, circumventing the state law designed to protect you? So it sort of creates a structural problem there. And then on top of that, you have the classification issue, which was very interesting the way that came up in the hearing because it was sort of dismissed as a concern. The general counsel of the FBI said, oh, you know, most of what the state and local police officers do is not classified, so that's really a misnomer that's a big concern. But then when one of the council members asked about why the mayor wasn't told about the Christmas tree lighting operation until after the event?
3 hours after.
Until after, they said, well, that's because it was classified. So I don't know how they didn't understand that they were trying to have it both ways there. You know, the classification system has both, you know, a very real and direct creates a real and direct obstacle to properly getting information to where it needs to go, you know, particularly if it's information that you're trying to take out of the FBI. But it also has a sort of a wider effect where it's not just that the document that I'm looking at is classified. It's that, well, if I give this piece of information that maybe isn't classified, could it implicate something that is? And so the easier solution because, you know, if you improperly withhold classified information that's not actually classified, you know what the penalty is? Nothing. But if you disclose something that was classified, the penalty is jail. So if I'm working in this environment and I say, well, I'm not sure if this is classified or not, it talks about things that I think are pretty sensitive, but it's not marked, am I going to take the risk of sharing that and go to jail or not? And typically what we find in the classified world is they don't. And that creates problems not just in public oversight, which is a lot of what the hearing was about, but also in security. You know, and if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they talk a lot about the cultural differences between the FBI and the CIA leading to this communications problem that prevented information from going across agencies. But that's baloney. The FBI was with the CIA in those and actually had access to the same information. The problem that occurred was that the FBI was not sharing it within the FBI. So there is no cultural problem between the FBI and the FBI. The problem was there was something marked at the top of the page that said, this is classified at such an extent that you can't share it with those other agents. And if you do, you will go to jail. So it had nothing to do with any cultural differences. It had to do with the fact that this information was well overclassified, and that overclassification is what raised the problems. To its credit, the 9/11 Commission did point out overclassification as a contributing factor to the failures. But you know what's been done? You know, right afterwards, to address the supposed lack of authority for the FBI to collect, they passed the Patriot Act. You know, they passed the FISA amendments. They did the NSA warrantless wiretapping. The collection was turned on. How about overclassification? What have they done to address that? Next to nothing. So it's not really about trying to fix what's broken. It's about gathering more authority within the intelligence community. And that's something that's really dangerous to our democracy, because as this secret government grows, you know, our ability as citizens to even understand what they're doing, much less curb their behavior, is very much reduced. And then the third aspect of your question about the structure is sort of the camaraderie that comes with being on a team. And, you know, it's very difficult to be the one that's saying, no, there's a problem here. And, you know, I know how hard that was when I was within the FBI and it was fellow agents I was complaining about. I can't imagine how difficult it would be for a police officer to come in and say that the FBI is doing something wrong, you know, not to mention whether the FBI would actually respond to that. And by overclassifying the information, it would be impossible for them to bring it back to city or state authorities in order to expose the wrongdoing. So it's an enormous problem. Anything else? She asked whether I knew what the budget for the Joint Terrorism Task Force is across the country is, and I'm sorry that I don't. Certainly the Joint Terrorism Task Forces have expanded enormously. You know, I think when, you know, before 9/11, there were probably, boy, I don't even know how many, probably less than 50 Joint Terrorism Task Forces. Now there are, I think, 100, close to that. Yeah. What's that? Yeah, I think it's over 100. So they've very much expanded their numbers, and, you know, so. Right, and if you look at, exactly, she's saying it, so they have an interest in expanding what they're doing, and I think that's what drives a lot of the abuse, is if you look at the IG report on the FBI's investigation of domestic advocacy groups, literally one of the abuses that they uncovered was the surveillance of a Thomas Merton Center for Peace and Justice anti-war rally and subsequent internet research that produced a memorandum on the people involved who had organized it. And that case, when the IG investigated it, was literally a young agent on the task force who didn't have much to do, who on a, I think it was a Friday after Thanksgiving, went to his supervisor and said, you know, what do you want me to do, boss? And the supervisor looked out the window and saw an anti-war rally and said, why don't you go down there and see if you can find terrorists? And so the young agent, being a dutiful young FBI agent, went down and took photographs and took down names and did research and wrote a detailed memo about people completely engaged in First Amendment-protected activities that never should have been done. And it's that kind of folly that comes from idle hands, you know, that, you know, okay, there aren't many terrorists, so what's close to a terrorist, you know, and we've seen that in so many ways. I mean, there was down in California, we had an instance where the Department of Defense had a terrorism training program, and one of the questions was, what is considered low-level terrorism? And it was a multiple choice, and the correct answer was protest. So, you know, there's a mindset that sort of leads to this, and, you know, with the lack of real subjects to investigate, you know, it goes again to the usual suspects, immigrants, people of color, and political dissidents. No, I don't think so. I mean, the question was whether the culture of the FBI changed under the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, and I don't believe it has. And part of that is by design. You know, after J. Edgar Hoover and everybody realized how bad it was for the FBI to be politicized, they tried to build in protections that would make sure that couldn't happen again. And one of those protections was creating a 10-year term for an FBI director. So the idea was that the FBI director would serve for beyond what the comings and goings of whoever was president or attorney general would have, so that he would remain somewhat independent. So the FBI is still run by the director, Robert Mueller, and Valerie Caproni has been there through the previous administration as well, the general counsel who came out to testify. So, the leadership of the FBI hasn't changed under the new administration, and I don't think the rank and file has changed much either.
What's lacking in oversight, and what would it take to correct that?
The question was, what's lacking in oversight, and what would it take to correct that? And there's a lot lacking in oversight. We could spend a lot of time talking about it. I mean, number one is the overclassification of information. We haven't lived with secret government forever. You know, this is only a post-World War II creation, this idea that we have secret agencies and secret conduct, you know, secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, secret committees in Congress. This is all sort of a new creation, and, you know, unfortunately, it has continually gained power. I don't know if you saw the Washington Post report on Top Secret America, where they reported, you know, how this thing has expanded so much that literally nobody knows how many people are employed in the national security establishment right now. And the sort of intelligence apparatus, which includes not just the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, but a myriad of private companies and quasi-government associations, that's really gone so out of control and produces so many reports that nobody can possibly read them all. So part of the problem is that we've had this, nobody has addressed the overclassification issue, and that our efforts of establishing oversight after the Church Committee report in the 1970s, which investigated the FBI and CIA and NSA abuses, decided that the way Congress could keep a handle on it is by having a secret committee that heard information in secret. And of course, that just created a bigger problem. And, it's just very difficult for those, you know, even if those congressmen had an interest in making this information public, You know, the fact that it's classified makes it very difficult for them to do something about it. And, of course, public officials can't bring the support for reform without having the public behind them. But if they can't tell the public what the problems are, it's hardly going to get fixed. And then this, one of the other major problems is that these agencies are exempt from the Whistleblower Protection Act. So whistleblowers within the agency have no protection from retaliation if they report misconduct within the agency. And that's really a huge part of the problem. And, you know, we had worked on a bill last year that would have provided some protections in the beginning. 2 years running, the House passed a very strong bill that would have provided them protections and the opportunity to go to court to sue to enforce their rights. But unfortunately, that was washed out in the negotiation process, and by the end, it was taken out of the bill altogether. So, you know, the intelligence community is a force unto itself, and it's able to make sure that reforms aren't met. And you know, even looking at something like the 9/11 Commission report, and you think, you know, here we have the most catastrophic intelligence failure since Pearl Harbor, and the solution that our government forms is give them more money, more manpower, more authority, and less oversight. And, you know, the idea that that would somehow make things better is a little bit ridiculous. And, you know, we really need to use, you know, where Congress could do a better job is, you know, particularly the Department of Justice Inspector General has done a great job with these IG reports that he puts out on a myriad of issues with the FBI. But that sort of just cracks the door open. He doesn't push the door completely open and demand reforms. He usually, you know, recommends a few tweaks to policy here and there, which would be fine if Congress took those reports and the, you know, very well-reported facts about what went wrong and used that as a starting point for investigations. But they don't do that. They usually use it as an opportunity to wag their finger at a hearing, and then that's the last we hear of it. So, you know, there are some out there. Actually, Senator Wyden has been very good for us trying to get information made public. You may have heard the Senate voted to extend the Patriot Act, the three expiring provisions of the Patriot Act for 3 months, which is interesting, so that more discussion can take place before they vote to decide whether to expand them for a longer period of time or try to narrow them as some, like Senator Leahy, has suggested. One of the authorities that's expiring is called the Section 215 Library Records provision, which is a provision under the Patriot Act where the FBI can go to this secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and submit an affidavit saying that the information that they want is relevant to a case. That's the only standard, that it's relevant. And then would get an order for literally what's called any tangible thing. So they can get anything based on this very low standard of relevance. The FBI only issues, according to their reporting, a little more than a dozen of these a year, which doesn't sound very significant. But Senator Wyden has written a letter to the Department of Justice saying that because of his position on the Senate Intel Committee, he knows that this authority is being used in a way that is much broader than would be imagined by the low numbers, and that the Department of Justice should declassify that program so that we would understand what it is we're talking about when we talk about how the FBI uses this authority. But so far, the Department of Justice has not responded. So we're hoping to get more information. We're hoping that if, you know, as these, you know, whether the period is 3 months or however long the extension ultimately is, that Congress actually demand these answers before they decide to act on the Patriot Act. You know, another provision that's really kind of interesting is I told you about these exigent letters. Well, the IG had been writing about this illegal program for 3 years when all of a sudden the FBI came up with a novel legal argument for why they should be able to get this information without legal process. This, again, is transactional information from the phone companies. And the Obama Department of Justice issued a legal opinion saying that the FBI was right, that there is some class of telephone records of Americans that they can seize without any legal process. So without any belief that you've done anything wrong, without anything. And we've tried to encourage, and I believe Senator Wyden, it may have been another senator, have asked for that to be declassified so we can get the letter to find out. You know, I mean, how absurd is this in a democracy that we don't even know how our government is interpreting the laws? You know, it's really an astonishing place that we find ourselves. So there are an awful lot of opportunities to improve oversight. And you know, unfortunately, the secrecy is killing us. The question was expressing some disappointment in the fact that the Obama administration has not made many efforts to reform national security policies that were put in place by his predecessor, and all I can do is wholeheartedly agree with you. We actually issued a report at the 18-month mark of the administration highlighting the fact that these policies that were once complained of when the previous administration was in power haven't been rolled back since the new administration came in. You know, particularly things like we've been trying very hard to get the Department of Justice to revise their guidance on racial profiling, which, you know, right now contain a broad exemption for national security or border integrity cases. So it's a loophole that swallows the rule. And also sort of sends the wrong message to state and local law enforcement that we're going to retain this technique for our most important cases, but it doesn't work, so you shouldn't use it. You know, it doesn't really pass the red face test for the state and local law enforcement officers who instead are following the lead of the Department of Justice and the FBI and you know, doing the same sort of things. But the reason we put out this report at 18 months was because we were concerned that it's what we called the new normal, and that, you know, these emergency measures that were put in place after 9/11 aren't being rolled back now that, you know, things are more normal, that sort of these emergency provisions are becoming normal. And that's something that I think we have to be very careful about, because, you know, it has long-term effects on our democracy when the government can target people because of their beliefs or advocacy on issues, and that's really more damaging than anything else.
By how this
I don't know that I can comment specifically on the Portland case, simply because I don't have enough details about it, and it's something that obviously will be tried in court, and we'll learn much more about it down the road. But as a general matter, we are very concerned about these techniques where, you know, the government is providing far more than the subjects of the investigation could have ever obtained on their own or showed any interest in previous to the government's intercession, either through informants or undercover operatives. And, you know, there are a number of problems. I mean, one, the entrapment defense, you know, when people sort of talk about it colloquially, they say, oh, it's entrapment, and the government then talks about a very narrow legal definition of what entrapment is and says, well, that defense didn't work in court, so it's not entrapment. And I think what the public means when they express concern about this is more sort of government misconduct in enticing somebody into something they would not have been capable of doing on their own. And these, there are cases in, you know, the Liberty 7 case in Florida, the Newburgh 4 case, they're all over the country. And I think it is different from the way things used to work. You know, I did undercover work. I never made a bomb for anybody. They gave me bombs. You know, that I was not providing weapons to anybody. And frankly, it would have been laughed at if I suggested it. So this is new that the government is providing all the mechanisms. And, you know, when one of these cases comes down, I always go to the indictment. And if this is a person who doesn't have weapons of their own, how much of a threat did they really present? And I'm not arguing that it's necessarily inappropriate for the government to pay attention to somebody who expresses some willingness and interest in trying to find somebody to help them do it, but to then turn it into a Cecil B. DeMille production is a different issue. And I have to wonder what the legitimate government purpose in that is, because I can't see it. In the Newburgh 4 case, they were all felons. All of the undercover agent or undercover informant had to do was sell them a pistol. They didn't have to sell them a Stinger missile. You know, I'm sure some of them couldn't spell Stinger missile and wouldn't have known what it was to ask for it. You know, if there was a threat, it could have been interdicted with much less of a aggrandizement of the case. So it's something troubling, and it's also troubling because there are a lot of people out there who build bombs. I mean, I'm going to be the last person who is ever going to tell you there aren't threats in the community. You know, there are, you know, I worked against neo-Nazis, I worked against anti-government militias. There are plenty of people out there who want to do harm. Why isn't this technique being used against any of them? You know, you don't see this technique being used against anyone but Muslims. And, you know, that raises another question about the legitimate, if it's a legitimate law enforcement technique, how come it isn't being used more broadly? So we do have a lot of questions about that, and there have been a lot of efforts to try to start gathering information about those cases to see if there's a way we can address it.
One of the, I think, compelling parts of the session today before the City Council was when Commissioner Leonard was grilling the federal representatives about why the mayor was not informed of the orchestrated attempted fake bombing at Pioneer Courthouse Square when the mayor was there at the square, and Commissioner Fish and his family were there at the square. And Randy Leonard was saying, you know, we have this resolution from 2005. We thought you all agreed to abide by this, to brief the chief of police and the mayor if there were ever a threat to Portland. And Art Balazan, the special agent in charge for the FBI, said, first of all, he wasn't aware of that, any such agreement, until it was brought to his attention after the fact, number one. And then, number two, that there was never any danger. And U.S. Attorney Dwight Holton, my compatriot from Willamette Week, he pro, me con, said, you know, this incident really didn't fit the criteria of that agreement because there was never any danger of a real threat. So I hope Steve Wax and the other federal defenders get transcripts of today's work session because it could be very helpful to them in representing their client who's being charged with terrorism. Question was that it's been very difficult to read where the council is on this issue through the process so far. I think that's going to change soon because I think members of the council are going to have to show their hand pretty soon. But nevertheless, I think they've made a point of being very deliberative here, all of them. You know, my handicapping of this at this point is that it's 2-2 with Mayor Adams as a swing vote. That Commissioner Saltzman and Commissioner Fish very much want Portland to rejoin the task force, but with appropriate safeguards in the memorandum of understanding, which we testified very clearly is impossible. And I think that I know that Commissioner Leonard is with us, and I think Commissioner Fritz is, but that's really a wild guess based on one comment she made today. You know, Mayor Adams was with us as a counselor 6 years ago. He was one of the four votes in favor of pulling out, but he's up for re-election next year. I would encourage all of you to study up on the issue. We've got all kinds of documents linked on our ACLU of Oregon website. There's a ton more links on the National ACLU website. We just posted a backgrounder on this issue on the ACLU of Oregon website that will appear in our upcoming newsletter that should be in the mail any day for those of you who are members. You know, I think it could go either way. I can tell you what we're going to be doing, which is trying to come up with language that we believe would be required both to implement the agreement from 2005 in a meaningful way, and also in response to requests from Commissioner Fish and a member of staff of one of the other commissioners. A list of criteria conditions that would have to be in an MOU if Portland rejoins the task force. Now, I can tell you those things are going to be things the FBI and the Justice Department cannot and will not do. Whether that will open any eyes on the council, I don't know. It never did before 2005, I can tell you that. And thank goodness for Tom Potter, who understood the chain of command, who understood how important the protection of civil liberties was as a former police chief. And, you know, if nothing else, this latest go-round in Portland is resulting in us not being alone. We had ACLU colleagues from San Francisco, Alan Schlosser, who is the legal director of the ACLU of Northern California, was here today just to watch and to see what Portland was doing, because they're fighting the same issue in San Francisco and in Oakland right now with their coalition partners. These issues are coming up around the country, and there will be an article, I expect, in tomorrow's LA Times, because there was a reporter from the LA Times who sat through the session today. So this is going to get more national attention. And there is an opportunity here, not only for Portland to reiterate the action it took in 2005, but to do so in a way that other cities and other local and state governments around the country should pay attention to.
Yeah, and Senator Leahy as well has introduced legislation that would narrow some of the authorities. So there are some people out there that are fighting, and we want to give them all the encouragement in the world. Yes. Right, coalition work with the librarians and the library associations has been fantastic, and you guys have really done. Right, yes. Right, and actually I was just looking because I knew as I was in between our meetings that I had seen something, and there's been a bill in the Senate introduced with just a three-month extension. So hopefully we will narrow down what I think it was Senator Feinstein had offered something that would expand or extend it for three more years. So anything that we can do to shorten that time period and to give support to Representative Conyers and Senator Leahy to create real reform on top of creating more avenues. I mean, the only reason we know about the abuse of the national security letters and the 215 powers and the exigent letters is because when Congress reauthorized the Patriot Act the first time, it required IG audits. And just on those two provisions, and then they discovered in that audit this third thing the FBI had made up on their own. So anytime you take a peek behind the curtain, there's abuse. You know, that's in my old law enforcement career what we called a clue. You know, that if you peel that curtain back further, you're going to find more abuse. And in addition to, narrowing those authorities, getting more oversight, getting these different OLC opinions and programs declassified, I think is key to understanding what it is the government's actually doing so we can build more public support for reform.
Thank you all again for coming out tonight. I hope we've given you some information to think on and act on. Thank you all for your support of civil liberties and the ACLU. Good night.